Thanks very much, Rob. We've had 55 minutes of speaking, so I suggest that if we want, we could have a 10-minute break.
Should we go straight onto it? Is that better?
Do you want to go straight
on? Yeah, I want to go straight onto it. It loses off. Momentum.
Okay, doke, yeah. Right. So, if in which not. Case...
Speak as the spirit moves you.
If we can have contributions from the floor.
Far better than Simon Sharp.
Thank you, man. Cool.
Very informative.
Thank you.
Trying to take some of it in at the moment.
All right, OK. What do you think it tells us about how revolutions actually work?
It tells us that they're very messy.
Yeah.
And wiggly. Alan Watts, the great Buddhist philosopher, said the universe is wiggly. And I think revolutions are wiggly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I agree with that, absolutely. They don't fall into pre-established concepts. The whole point of a historical materialist approach is not to impose arbitrary categories from the present and impose them on the past and say they've always rigidly applied. You know, so the way we do revolution now isn't necessarily going to be the same in different parts of the past or in other parts of the world even now. I think it's fairly obvious.
Anyone else? Is that a hand up there?
If the English Revolution had succeeded, what would have happened? Something like in America?
Yeah, I mean, more or less. What certain people like Sexby, for example, were advocating was redistribution of land, of royalist land. You know, if you could have had a more decentralised power structure based around county administrations, all right? You know, you could have had successful digger communities set up and not actually harassed and destroyed by the owning class. You could have had at least a much wider sort of sense of participation and ownership. Now, you know, of course you would never have moved into a post-capitalist society because, as I've sort of said, capitalism was still in the modern capitalism, of course, was still in the process of formation at this point. But yeah, you would have had something like not just like the United States, but a more democratic version of the United States Revolution, of the American Revolution. You know, bear in mind the people who set up the United States have far more in common with the grandees and the conservative elements in Parliament that I described, i.e. the big landowners, than ever they do the radical formations. You know, the American Constitution says all men are born free, except the ones that are worth like more than £10, you know. Then you're not free. You know, it reinforces property rights. You know, it does all of that sort of thing. You know, it's a very dated document, the American Constitution, you know, for all its claims to universality and to be applicable today. And actually shows you who was making the American Revolution and who was sort of leading it. And certainly, you know, the English Revolution, right up until 1649, wasn't as conservative as the American Revolution. It was far more radical. Far more populist, far more radical.
Any other hands?
Yes.
What level of income per person of Britain and America compared to
that? What was the...
level of income? I mean, GDP of
Britain. I've got no idea. I mean, America this time is just, you know, the colonies around Massachusetts. Oh, what? What an incredibly Eurocentric imperialist thing to say. There were lots of people in America, they just weren't counted as people at the time, were they? You know, the Europeans.
No, I don't mean capitalists. I wanted to know just GDPs, companies. I wanted just to know the GDP companies.
I don't know what the GDP was at the time, I've got to be honest. I've got no idea. I'm not even sure.
What was the revolution exactly?
Sorry?
The revolution here, what was it?
Yeah. The revolution here in England?
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, it was whereby the process where authority broke down. There was class conflict between, sections of the ruling class, one of which basically take on the formation of the modern bourgeoisie in this country. It's important to note, in Britain, that the formation of the bourgeoisie in this country doesn't take on the old classical Manichean Marxist view of aristocracy being replaced by bourgeoisie. What happens is the two merge, essentially. And with the defeat of the English Revolution... Exactly. And of course, you know, as I was saying, what you're seeing is also on below the formation of other classes, which eventually, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, ends up becoming the working class. You know, popular defence of Parliament spurred events. Yeah, it drove the course of the English Civil War by people organising themselves to defeat the enemy, and then afterwards was stamped down on by this emerging, you know, ruling class, of which Cromwell was part. All right, Cromwell was essentially the gravedigger of the English Revolution. Yeah.
Rob, also had a point.
Just while you're thinking, then, and to
it's gone. It'll come back another time.
I'll give people a chance to have a think about a question. I took some notes down while Rob was speaking. I've got one question, but some resources that people might be interested in looking up further. There was, it turns out it was in 1988, but it keeps getting repeated on Radio 4 Extra, a 12-part BBC radio drama about the English Revolution called God's Revolution, which is certainly worth checking out if it comes round again. And every time it comes round, someone sends an email out going, it's on the radio again, listen in. I'm sure someone somewhere has copied it and has an option.
YouTube,
possibly it's out there. On YouTube. A useful book, I don't know if Rob writes it highly, Edward Bernstein's Cromwell and Communism. Which we certainly have copies in the party library. There's an interesting, again, if someone comes up on Forex from time to time, Mark Steele lecture on Oliver Cromwell, which just shows the rather bizarre and incredible trajectory of him. Apparently, at the signing of the death warrant of Prince of King Charles, him and a couple of the other signatories had an ink fight, flicking ink at each other and flying around. And there's I think we've got the video and the DVD in the library of the film about Gerard Wynne Stanley that was made in the 1960s, which is certainly worth a look. 1970s, sorry, it looks like it's the 60s. But just to throw a question to Rob to keep things ticking over, could you link this in with the ideological use of the Glorious Revolution and what happened in 1688?
Oh, okay.
Nice easy one for you.
Yeah, okay. Great, yeah, the Glorious Revolution. I actually wrote an essay in one of my final history exams at university, which was, you know, the old cliche, you know, the Glorious Revolution was neither glorious nor a revolution. Discuss. You go, yeah, that's about right. No, slightly facetious, but, you know, that's one that's bored history students for centuries, I should imagine. Basically, what happens is that with the Restoration, they do a very forced, hurried negotiation with Charles. He gets the better of it. Basically, Charles II would have been like his father, except he was far more indolent, far more fatter, and far more interested in getting his end away and getting drunk than he was to creating an absolutist project. And I'm not being facetious. Basically, what happened was, when he died, he converted to Catholicism on his deathbed, and his son, James his brother, James II, James, you know, Charles I's other idiot son, basically tried to revive what his father was doing and tried to turn not even Episcopalian as well. He tried to turn England Catholic. There were huge popular uprisings at the time. The Monmouth Revolt in 1685, in the West Country being one of the biggest. Unfortunately, that got put down. And with it, a lot of old veterans of the English Revolution, you know, who were left, were taken out. Basically, what happened was James's behaviour was completely, completely unacceptable for Parliament. And so, basically, they petitioned yet another Stuart, Mary Stuart, who was married to William of Orange, to take over. And the Dutch fleet turned up at the Thames to, you know, widespread panic. But basically, you know, they let him in. And he was taken over. At that point, they didn't make the same mistake twice, and there was a much more formal constitutional settlement, which is embodied in the 1688 Bill of Rights and all those silly rules that they have whereby the heir of the heir to the English throne has to marry a virgin or non-Catholic and all that kind of nonsense. But, you know, I mean, it was certainly way, way short of anything like, you know, the agreement of the people. And, you know, obviously, certainly short of something like the American Constitution. Basically, what it was just sort of finishing off the process that began in 1660 with the handy byproduct of finishing off the last of the radicals, you know, in the Monmouth Rebellion.
Right, you've had a chance to remember what your point was.
Did come back, actually. yeah, Rob. what you described, I mean, class, different class compositions are quite complex.
Yeah.
It wasn't a simple model.
No.
It was a whole set of complex relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
So two points I want to raise on this. One is that there's an old argument, certainly not put out by the Socialist Party, which is that in times of revolution, elements of the ruling class can drop into the revolutionary forces. So my first question is, probably might have mentioned it, I don't know it, I'll ask you to comment on that. Were there elements of the ruling class maybe drop, went from the royalist side to the parliamentary side? Well, for various reasons, could be pragmatic, could be ideological, whatever. And the second one is, bring up to date, in terms of the old arguments about class analysis and who's in the working class, who's in the ruling class, and is there a middle class? Mm. We're the 1%, they're the 99%, or the other way around. What does your historical study or your historical survey of that period in terms of class composition tell us about how we analyse class today?
Okay.
Is it more wiggly and messy than perhaps the imaginative view?
Okay. Well, to deal with the first point, yes, you know, there were members of the ruling class that joined Parliament, but I mean, as I've mentioned, the lines between the traditional aristocratic ruling class and the higher end of, you know, commoners, rich merchants, yeomen, farmers, and so forth was already blurring. The early parliamentarian leaders, the useless ones, the Earl of Manchester and the Earl of Essex, were major members of the nobility, but. You know, through their own consciences and whatever, they didn't necessarily like Episcopalianism, or at least its imposition, and they certainly didn't want Charles to create an absolute state and wanted to, you know, essentially have the old status quo back. Definitely there were lots of them. And of course, you know, these rising sort of members of the ruling class are embodied, you know, handily by the two leaders of the new model, Thomas Cromwell, yeoman farmer, and Sir Thomas Fairfax. And Thomas Fairfax's family were yeoman farmers from about, you know, 100 years before. So, you know, he'd been knighted and they were now part of the lesser gentry. That did go on. On the other end of things, it can get quite messy as well. I guess if I was criticising my own talk, I'd say I've been a bit too simplistic in saying that... towns and whatever in industrial and manufacturing areas automatically were Puritan and automatically went to Parliament, because that didn't happen in Cornwall. And Cornwall's a major exception. A lot of the manufacturing tin mining areas there went royalist. But then again, on the other hand, the backwoods, you know, rural labourers like my ancestors up in East Cornwall tended to be firmly parliamentarian, because they hated their local parliamentarian squires and they wanted to tear down enclosure fences. The situation in Cornwall was especially bloody, you know, because basically the royalists then went around to every village, kind of killing anyone who resisted them. So there's that. Yeah, you see people joining the royalist cause, you can see why they might have done it for more kind of class reasons, because they didn't like their you know, Puritan, you know, employers. Whereas in the whereas in the east of the county, you know, dispossessed peasants and whatever, who before would have been naturally doff your cap, yes sir, yeah, types, are going, no, sod this, they're burning down the manor and saying we support Parliament. And I'm sure local history studies, if anybody knows any, can come up with lots of examples of this. So that's the first part. The second part, I've got to be honest with you. I think class lines, especially in times of class violence and uprisings and whatever, can become blurred. There's no question about it. One of my main points, one of my main reasons for studying this, and why it's not just a kind of historical curiosity, you know, after all, I'm not just an antiquarian, is to try and understand how class conflict actually works in the real world, rather than in, you know, the predetermined, often very rigid and to some extent idealist categories that people sometimes come up with. So, yeah, you know, there's no question about that. I mean, I think particularly there's a blurring of the lines today, in from an SPGB point of view, between, you know, what is the upper part of the working class and where does the ruling class begin? Certainly. I mean, I think that's fairly self-obvious. You know, I mean, whilst they may work for a wage, I would say that a lot of the people who, especially at the upper echelons, man the state's security apparatus are part of the ruling class. I don't see that as controversial. You know, I see a lot of people who work as, say, corporate lawyers and stockbrokers and things like that. Yeah, they're workers technically, but, you know, they're essentially part of the ruling class. You know, and moreover, they're probably more ideologically inclined to go against the revolution. Whereas, you know, you said a very important point there. There's a popular consciousness. Yeah, is that what you said? A popular, a radical consciousness, yeah? Well, look at some of the people who support UKIP. All right, I mean, they're easy enough to laugh at, but they have some genuine concerns about... Well, or the EDL, of course. You know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, let's not... and I mean, I know I get over-emotional and very guilty about this. I tend to go, bloody fascists, they're all horrible scum. And, of course... You know, look at the people who are making up. They're predominantly white working class people, alienated people. You know, they should be on our side. They shouldn't be out burning down mosques and hurting black people and Muslims. You know, they should be on our side. So you know, why is that? Well, you know, as you say, there are dynamics going on here. This is why you've got to look at society, I think. I know it's a sort of slightly simplistic way for more sort of sophisticated theoretical types, but you know, the old economic base ideological superstructure model, without getting all French Althusserian about it, you know. What I like about the English historians, the English Marxist historians, is that they resolutely put class struggle and human beings' actions at the centre of history, all right, rather than blind impersonal economic forces, which can, these formulations, especially of Althusser, I mean, I remember reading Althusser at university, thinking this is great, and then I like looked into it, for example, his ideas of state ideological apparatuses. You know, I read a bit of Noam Chomsky about the propaganda media of the model, and went, oh yeah, Althusser's talking absolute bollocks, isn't he? You know, this is completely unworkable. You know, the idea that a newspaper is some kind of rigid, oh, state ideological structure. I mean, come on, how Manichean and simplistic is that? It's ridiculous. That's not how the real world works, you know. So, I mean, there's a common thread between my interest in propaganda, all right, because a lot, bear in mind, Dave, I mean, as you possibly remember, mate, a lot of my awakening an interest in why people think certain things came during when we were in Lancaster during our opposition to the First Gulf War.
Halcyon days.
Yeah, when I could still see my knees when I stood up, yeah. When I could fit in my leather kicks. But anyway, more importantly, I mean, but seriously, I mean, I wondered how can people support this barbarity? How can you do it? Well, obviously, there are answers to that. Exactly the same shit's going on now. You know, and I mean, why? And then again, I know sort of some pacifists and whatever may not want to hear this, but you know, why now in the US and in Britain is support for ongoing imperial occupations like in Afghanistan coming apart? It's because they're losing. All right, yeah, you might not want to hear that, and I'm not necessarily arguing for national liberation politics. In fact, you know, I'm not. I think it's a fundamentally, you know, anti-working class position. But you know, you've got to acknowledge that when enough kind of body bags start coming home, people won't support it anymore. It's that simple. It's that horrible concrete truth that rips away the veneer, and you actually see the consequences of imperialism, of the state, and what capitalism does to people. Not to people who look like they're in a video game halfway around the world, or you know, denounced as mindless Islamic terrorist, fascist, whatever, to actual human beings that you know. Well, that's when it starts to come home. So, yeah, what happens essentially in revolutionary situations is, apart from all this kind of grim stuff, it's an amazing period of liberation. You know, what's the name of Christopher Hale's famous book? The World Turned Upside Down. Old systems of deference come apart, as I was saying. You know, people who had no enfranchisement before, who had no rights to position in public life, women, servants, the labouring poor, you know, even the poor and destitute, now have a voice. They now have an organisation. They may do crazy shit. all right, like they did in the English Revolution, particularly after 49, a lot of the religious sectaries sort of either became very inward-looking and pacifistic, like the Quakers, or they became absolutely crazy millenarians, like the Fifth Monarchists, who were basically saying, we don't need to participate in politics anymore. Christ is coming to save us all. The kingdom of the Lord is at hand. All right, yeah, it sounds crazy, but it's reflecting a genuine desire for a juster, fairer society and for social peace. So in that sense, you know, you can't ignore it, and you can't just glibly condemn it as reactionary, I guess. Up until the point that they start, up until the point they start taking action against you, of course.
Yeah,
as soon as the EDL chuck a brick through a window, I'm chucking the brick back at the bastards.
Right, does anyone else have any questions?
Yes, you mentioned the Levellers. I mean, did they have any organisation outside of the army?
Yes, they certainly did. Yeah, they certainly did. I mean, there were Levellers outside of the army. People like a couple of the guys who spoke at the Putney debates, whose names are escaping me at the moment, who were specifically invited. There was a guy who was a lawyer. Oh, I can't remember his name. I'm really sorry. But he was one of the major speakers at the Putney debates. I didn't bring the book with me. Like I said, what the Levellers were essentially was a self-defined loose network. All right, so...
A bit like Al-Qaeda.
Well, actually a bit more like anti-capitalist groups, yeah. Like Occupy, that sort of thing. Yeah, or indeed the First International. They were better, like I said, at protesting than they were at actually organising and taking power. You know, and one of the key masterstrokes, as it were, in 49 was to declare the Republic, to declare religious toleration, because it just took the carpet, it swept the carpet right out from under a lot of the Levellers. They didn't even have to get going again until Cromwell started cracking down on religious dissent after 53. Again, that's when Lilburn was imprisoned. Ironically enough, of course, in Oliver Cromwell's maiden speech to Parliament in 1640, he called for Lilburn's release. So it goes.
Right. Yes.
Then exactly in your viewpoint, the capitalist class was powerful in this.
Sorry, when was the capitalist?
Then the capitalist power class exactly got the power in this.
When did they get power?
When did the capitalist class get power?
Yes,
do you mean in the modern sense of the word? You could argue 1688 or after the Industrial Revolution. The point is that the period we're talking about is what when they're in formation. I'm always very, very wary of these kind of questions. I'll be honest. You know, I've had somebody ask me before, when did socialism become possible? To which I facetiously answer, 25th of May, 1888, round about tea time. Happy now? You know. You can't. Get out, you heretic, right now. Bloody lunch.
Hang on, he's got a follow up.
Oh, sorry.
What about roughly when capitalism?
Well, I mean, capitalism in its modern form is certainly recognisable, say, by the end of the 18th century when the Industrial Revolution's kicked off. But I think it's long before then. I think the British state and the British ruling class are in formation here, and they're essentially cemented in place by the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and then further modified, you know, by the Act of Union with Scotland in 1707. That's when Great Britain itself is formed. All right, by now, and obviously they bring the Hanoverians in for sort of stability, because Queen Anne didn't have any children. Then, basically, by the beginning of the 18th century, certainly. If I ever get around to doing a sequel to this talk, I desperately want to do one on the 18th century. So, for example, you know, the Black Act of 1723, which is actually a law passed by Parliament, creating, I think it was 18 capital offences against property. So that's when stealing a sheep became a hanging offence. All right, absolutely barbaric, authoritarian society, Britain in the 18th century. You know, it's lauded as you're growing up by the bourgeoisie as being this wonderful halcyon age of a polite and commercial people. It was nothing of the sort. You know, the Marxist historian Peter Linebaugh calls it a thanatocracy, you know, just by analysing the levels of capital punishment. anyway, that's for another day. But you know, this is the blood in which capitalism and our ruling class are forged. It's not nice and it's not pretty. And as I said before, they've got longer historical memories than us. We need to be educating ourselves in these matters to discover where our history comes from.
Right, before coming back to Dave, I assume you're not going to want to go on too much longer.
I don't mind. Okay.
I'll just check in as long as...
I should imagine most of you guys don't want to go on any longer. I can go on about this all night.
Right, well, anyway, we'll have to show a bit of mercy at some point. Anyway, right, so, but in any case, while this next couple of questions are going on, I'm going to start passing around the collection pot, and then Dave.
Yeah, Roger, because you mentioned the coterie of Marxist historians that existed and worked around the 60s and the 70s, particularly, or maybe from the 50s.
And later. And it's still going.
I'd like for you to say a little bit more about them, the things they have in common and their sort of relationship with maybe the people like Alice there, and how they find themselves.
Sure, absolutely.
How they find Marxism.
Absolutely. Well, as I've already said, I'm a big fan of what's known as English Marxism. I mean, as you can probably tell from this talk, I mean, yeah, this talk is basically Christopher Hill sort of strained through Brian Manning and James Halston and myself. They have this idea, I've already said this, you know, that the human beings and the human action is at the centre of the driving motor of history. And I think that's very, very positive. A lot of them were members of the Communist Historians Group, the older ones. So we're talking Maurice Dobb, Christopher Hill, and E.P. Thompson, of course. Now, they all left the Communist Party in 1956, with the famous exception of Eric Hobsbawm. Hobsbawm was the only one who remained in the Communist Party. The rest of them left, and that's when they start to get interesting. That's certainly when Christopher Hill's work starts to get interesting. All right, the stuff he wrote when he was still in the Communist Party isn't worth shit, basically. It's a mechanistic regurgitation of the, you know, the sort of, they wouldn't say it, but the, you know, the Trotsky view that I sort of said. It's when he left the party and was freed from the shackles and the ideological shackles of that reactionary organisation, that counter-revolutionary organisation, the Communist Party, that they became interesting. When I was at university in the early 90s, you had the last kind of gasp of a lot of these guys. You know, Manning wrote, he reissued The English People and the English Revolution, and he wrote his second book, 1649, in 92. Christopher Hill wrote his last Liberty Against the Law in 1996, before he died. But it kind of carries on. There's Robert Brenner, who I haven't mentioned, actually. Brenner's not an English Marxist. All right, but he wrote a major, major study called Merchants and Revolution, which came out in 1993. Now, it's a big, imposing slab of a book. Brenner's book is superb in what it does, in highlighting the divides in the bourgeoisie at the time. Okay, so it's a mechanistic idea that all merchants would have been supporters of Parliament, because they weren't. All right, what essentially you had in London was a conflict between the older guild merchants in the established companies, who were absolutely in favour of absolutism, because that's who they owned their patronage, their position to, and who Charles needed to fund his project. All right, and it was the kind of the rising stars, the kind of young Turks of the emerging bourgeoisie, if you like, who were the ones who were supporting Parliament. And these weren't necessarily nice people, and, you know, bear in mind, these were people who would have had direct holdings both in, you know, America and Massachusetts, and in, well, you know, in the Caribbean. The sugar and slave plantation system, moreover, is established at this time. But it's not necessarily with black African slaves, all right? It's with exiles and prisoners from the English Civil War, Irish, and then, you know, later on people like Hugh Peter, who were exiled. And of course, then they're supplemented later on by captured African slaves. You know, the slave trade expands in the 18th century. You know, so bear in mind, you know, they're not necessarily nice people in that sense. But nevertheless, they're on Parliament's side. You know, also, they form the core, along with the army grandees, of the conservative faction that led the counter-revolution. So Brenner's book's interesting. What it misses is any surprisingly, and I was really shocked when I read it, there's not much about popular participation at all. And it's very London-centric as well. That's what Brian Manning said in his review of the book at the time when it came out, and he's absolutely spot on the money about it. Now, don't get me wrong, I've got a lot of respect for Robert Brenner's historical work, not necessarily some of his up-to-date commentary. But Brenner's a very, very important historian on the origin of capitalism. Absolutely key. He writes in earlier stuff about how stuff that was going on in the 15th century in Europe, and the absolute crisis of the peasantry that happened then, basically like laid the roots for the development of capitalism. Because what it did was it opened up a space where people could begin to buy land because of depopulation, the wars, the Black Death, and all the rest of it. This is west of the Elbe. East of the Elbe, a completely different form of feudalism survived. And this is where people often get kind of confused and don't differentiate between the two. Because what was going on there? Serfdom, which wasn't even abolished. You're directly owned by your landowner. That wasn't even abolished in the Tsarist Empire until 1861. Thank you. Yeah, I think I told you that.
25 years ago.
Yeah, all right. There you go. So Brenner's important in that respect. What was I talking about? Never mind.
Okay, well, actually, I was going to come on to ask you about this question, because I think it would be useful to know. You touched on the international situation. So what effect was the international politics of Europe on the English Revolution at that time?
It's not directly affected in that it wasn't a knock-on. All right, bear in mind, in the 17th century, Europe is in absolute turmoil. I mean, absolute turmoil. The 30 Years' War and the Counter-Reformation are going on. The Turks are trying to expand the Ottoman Empire, the famous Siege of Vienna in 1648 and all that stuff. Europe is in absolute turmoil. The Russian state is in the process of forming itself into what will become the Tsarist Empire and is at war with all comers, particularly the Swedes. Who are also taking part in the 30 Years' War. It's an absolute mess, frankly. The only effect it had, tangentially, of course, was once it started to settle down, by about 1648, was also when the English Civil War had ended. And there was a threat, there was a direct threat to the English Revolution from Spain and from France, all right? Now, I mean, I unequivocally condemn what Cromwell did in Ireland. Nevertheless, he had to secure his flanks. Again, it's simple common sense. They could not let an insurrectionary royalist Ireland be an open door for Spain or France to help invade the English Republic. So that rebellion had to be ended. I mean, he didn't have to do it in the way he did, and he didn't have to make payment conditional on, plundering Ireland, and of course, people took land there. That's part of one of the main bits of the Protestant seeding of Ireland. And that's why I said it created divisions that last to this day. So he didn't need to do that, but he had to secure his flanks. The army had to intervene in the Scottish Civil War, not just for solidarity and ideological purposes, but to defeat Charles II, who otherwise would have led another army down into England. So you're sometimes faced with these unpalatable choices when you're in these situations. And that was definitely the main effect Europe had. It was a sort of sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the revolution. And this is why, of course, Cromwell massively strengthened the Royal Navy, which incidentally, by and large, supported the parliamentarian cause, right away from the start and all the way through. I think there were literally a couple of ships in Portsmouth where some officers were stupid enough to say they supported the king, and they were basically thrown over the side, and that was that, so Cromwell, of course, also fought a series of wars against the Dutch. I'll say that again, the Dutch, or the Protestant Dutch. You would think they had some sort of solidarity. No, because this is emerging capitalist competition for trade routes, for markets. This is the reason, eventually, why New York's called New York and not New Amsterdam. We nicked it, in the words of Blackadder, to paraphrase. The British nicked it.
Hence why the adjective Dutch is usually used to mean something quite bad.
Yes, of course.
Going Dutch, double Dutch, numerous other phrases and things in the language.
Yeah, exactly.
400 years on, still not forgotten. Right, anyone else? Yes.
What should Cromwell have done in Ireland?
Well, like I said, he should not have killed everyone he came across. He should not have redistributed land and ceded the Protestants there. Put it down, occupy the Pale like they always used to, and let the rest of Ireland organise itself. You know, you can use the Pale as a base to put down any landings. Or
the Catholics were, as you say, the fifth columns of France and Spain.
Sure. You ruthlessly put them down. But what you don't do
ruthlessly put them down, fair enough.
Yeah. You don't do things like the massacre of Drogheda, which was purely driven by hatred.
Didn't they do things like that as well?
Sure, but that doesn't make it right, does it? Mm-hmm. You know, just because a few Viet Cong beheaded a few American soldiers didn't mean you declared it was right for them to declare an entire free fire zone and slaughter everyone in villages, did it?
Apparently Cromwell gets a bad press over there.
I think he deserves a bad press for the social consequences. I think you're right, it needs to be put down, as I've said. Again, it's one of those horrible situations. You find yourself in revolutionary situations.
Well,
you know.
I mean, that one's recently been debated in the letters pages of the Morning Star.
Right.
With pro and anti-Cromwell sides being taken to this day. So, and, of course, his statue remains outside Parliament.
Mm.
Right, does anyone else...
As does, of course, Queen Boadicea, our great insurgent leader against the Roman occupation. Solidarity, brother.
Right, does anyone who hasn't asked the question yet who wants to come forward with any? If not, I think, as you said, we've had a football match worth...
Oh, let's keep going. It's only half past four.
We have to show mercy at some point. And unless there's any more questions, we'll wind up. Rob, do you have anything you want to say to wind everyone up?
Not really. I think I've done it enough already.
Okie doke. In which case, thank you all very much for coming on and listening. And doubtless there'll be lingering and chatting going on.
Two bickies.
Two coffee upstairs.
We usually. Right, I need a cup of tea. Oh.